Greetings, listeners. Welcome to the July 13th edition of the Heretics Hour with me, your host, Carolyn Yeager. My guest for this program is Warren B. Routledge, who is returning for a second appearance on the Heretics Hour after being on the show last May. Today we're going to delve further into Warren's book, which is titled Holocaust High Priest, Elie Wiesel, Night, the Memory Cult, and the Rise of Revisionism. If you haven't read it yet, you really need to, and it's available at all major book outlets as well as at the Barnes Review. This book is a real tell-all that cuts through most of the nice things you read about Wiesel in the Zionist-controlled news and gives the facts about this imposter as far as they can be determined. So hello, Mr. Warren Routledge, and thank you for coming on my show again.
I'm happy to be with you, Carolyn. I look forward to this discussion.
Now, you've been pretty busy since your book came out. Are you satisfied with the response that your book has gotten?
Well, I think the response has been very, very good. Indications are from my publisher that the sales of the book have been quite robust. And when he sent me a royalty check, I almost fell off my chair. I couldn't believe he made. So that was astonishing, especially because it was only for the first 6 weeks of sales, and he pays royalties every 3 months, and I only covered 6 weeks of that 3 month period. So I was quite delighted to see that the book is selling, and I thank those nationwide, worldwide, in the revisionist community, and especially also those outside who are getting acquainted with the realities of the Holocaust narrative through my book. I want to thank all those people who have purchased it. Another interesting thing, as many of your listeners will know, is that when you sell a book on Amazon, people are buyers, ideally people who have read the book, are allowed to come in and to comment on the book and offer positive or negative comments. And the book, last time I looked, had six excellent positive comments, all seemingly, the evidence would indicate, from people who had actually bought the book and read the book. On the other hand, there are five negative comments, all written by what appear to be Jewish advocates, if not Jewish people themselves, who've written to say, oh, this book is just a bunch of garbage, it's junk, it's written by another Holocaust denier, and so forth. And there's not one person even wrote and said, I refuse to read this book because I know it's full of lies. So you can see the other side that we're trying to communicate with. They're a little bit upset about the book because it's just chock full, loaded with truth and proof about what a liar and a sham and a con man Elie Wiesel actually is. They're not happy about it.
No, they're not at all, are they? And your book is so comprehensive. That's probably what really upsets them. And I haven't looked on that Amazon page for quite a while, but when I did a month ago, you were getting quite a lot of comments, and I did notice those comments from those people who don't want people to read your book. That's the story there. Well, that's all very interesting, and I really do congratulate you on getting a royalty check already, and you certainly deserve it. The last time you were on, I wanted to focus on Wiesel's relationship with François Mauriac, and who was the French Nobel Prize-winning novelist who helped to such a great extent in getting Night not only published, but even written. And you talked about that. And plus, we also talked about whether he had actually been in the camps that he says he was in and all of that, which I think is highly important. And that's one of the things that is upsetting these Zionist promoters so much. But in this program, I've asked you to talk about Wiesel's abusive, and that's your word, relationship with the Catholic Church, and specifically certain popes and cardinals. And you go into that in pretty good detail in your book. I would really like for you to cover that on today's program.
Well, I'd start by saying that Elie Wiesel's career and the Second Vatican Council pretty much occur at the same time. And at the Second Vatican Council, the liberals who were taking over the Catholic Church after the death of Pius XII really established their power. And many of these people were Judeophiles and wanted to, and were often as self-interested in becoming Judeophiles as intellectuals and writers. It's always much more money to be made if you're working for the mainstream press, which is Jewish-dominated and oriented, than if you're just working for simple Catholic publications with low salaries and lack of ability to hit a wide market. And I'll talk later on today about various Catholic intellectuals who jumped on the Elie Wiesel bandwagon to talk about how they've increased their salaries and their incomes dramatically by hopping on that bandwagon. There were people who wanted to see changes in the Catholic Church, and specifically John the 23rd, when he succeeded Pius the 12th. He wanted to make an overture to the Jewish organizations and to kind of create a peace treaty, make what they called in those days a statement on the Jews. And during the 3 years, the four sessions of the Vatican Council, the New Yorker magazine, the New York Times, and the rest of the establishment press reported on the Vatican Council during those four sessions of from 62 to 65, as if that was the only subject being debated. What would the Declaration on the Jews actually turn out to be? Well, they lobbied so hard and so firmly during the first two sessions in the fall of 62 and 63 that they wore out all their goodwill with all the people who were not particularly, who were just middle of the road attendees at the Vatican Council. The Jewish lobbyists directly and also working through their Catholic puppets just wore everybody down. And what they had expected to pass very easily in the first or second session wasn't even discussed in the third session. So when they finally got to the last section in 1965, and they were able to pass the so-called statement on the Jews, but it was so dramatically watered down tremendously from what it had originally been when it was first proposed in 1962. Instead of having a so-called separate statement on the Jews, they were put in under the general subject of dialogue with non-Christian religions. They were tucked in there. Concessions were doubtless made to them, but not as radical as the ones that were originally planned.
Well, let me just ask right in here, because I imagine some people are thinking about this question, and that is, do you think that John the 23rd was put in there by Jews or Jewish interests for this very purpose, or did he just happen to win? Was he just so liberal, or what's the history of him?
Well, there was Cardinal Beyer, who was a German-born cardinal, who was working first for John the 23rd until he died, then for Paul the 6th, who was orchestrating all the negotiations with the Jewish organizations in New York City. He headed an Irish-born assistant named Malachy Martin. And Malachy Martin, unbeknownst to Cardinal Beyer, took every single secret document, every private document from Cardinal Beyer's office and sent it over, had couriers going back and forth to the American Jewish Committee. So the American Jewish Committee knew even before Cardinal Beyer's staff was going to launch a new initiative or prepare to do something at Rome. In Rome, the Jewish side knew all about what was coming even before other Catholics knew about it, because Malachy Martin was feeding all this information to them. He was an inside spy working for the other side. It's absolutely scandalous, and no one has ever been brought to justice. The whole story has yet to have been told in a mainstream environment where it should be. But one point I make at the end of this session, the part of the book where I discuss this, I took a quote from the Cardinal Archbishop of Boston at that time, Cardinal Cushing, and he was quoted in Look magazine as saying, if the Jewish lobbyists had not done what they did and not behaved the way they had, there would have been a statement on the Jews, a much more potent and direct one, earlier on in the council, with some saying that they had sabotaged their own efforts by their pushiness in trying to control the whole process. In any case, what happened was a new friendship, quote-unquote, friendship was born, in which the Catholic Church, instead of protecting its people for generations and centuries against U.S. economic, social, and cultural warfare against the Catholic masses, the church, instead of protecting its own people against Jewish influences, instead became allies and friends. Not only becoming friends with various rabbis at the American Jewish Committee and Anti-Defamation League and World Zionist Congress and so forth, but it also meant becoming a de facto ally of Israel, a militarist state, an apartheid state. And that had really, really grave consequences, because it means that the Catholic Church no longer had any neutrality. Once it became allied with the Zionist entity at the Second Vatican Council and the years after that, its wiggle room to criticize anything coming out of Israel was pretty close to zero. So then in the 70s and 80s, as the Israelis continued to steal Palestinian land, but also especially to circumscribe the activities of Catholics in the Holy Land. For instance, Catholic priests, Catholic churches, Catholic priests and Catholic churches, their freedom of movement and freedom of speech is very, very strictly compromised. And the Catholic Church and the Israeli authorities, ever since the beginning of the creation of Israel, the Catholic Church has refused to pay real estate taxes and other taxes associated with their lands and holdings. And the reason they have given is that they never paid taxes before. In fact, from before the Ottoman Empire period, from about 1900 until 1948, when Israel was created, the Vatican essentially ran. The Vatican, or Rome, the Pope, ran the Holy Land, ran those places. And of course, he didn't tax himself. When the Jews took over Israel, they immediately set about wanting to tax all church property because they didn't recognize the Catholic Church as being anything special. Well, believe it or not, until this day and age, the Catholic Church has never paid up on those tax assessments. And they're in the tens of billions of dollars right now. Mm. We read occasionally in a Catholic newspaper that those negotiations are continuing. But why, with those negotiations going onward in 1993, did John Paul II, misguided, if there ever was a misguided and troubled man, why did he recognize Israel while those negotiations were going on? He only strengthened their hand by recognizing them as an official state. He never should have recognized Israel. So now, for instance, if the Israelis don't like a particular Catholic priest, or if some one of the members of a particular religious order says something or does something or walks on the street in a way that they don't like, they arrest them. They hold them for a couple of days. They have no right to arrest or detain in any way Catholic clergy persons. Also, they make it very difficult. In fact, there's a law in the Israeli Knesset right now to nationalize all Catholic schools, and something like 75% of the kids in those schools are Palestinians who are not even Catholics. The Israeli government wants to bring those schools completely under the Israeli state curriculum for public school, whereas these schools, the Catholic schools, have more an international curriculum that would be more like something you'd find in France, Germany, or the United States. And so it's difficult for the authorities in the Catholic Church, who meet from time to time with the Jewish side, to discuss these tax and independence and freedom of movement issues when you've already given your diplomatic recognition to what is essentially a rogue state and a criminal state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, lots of mistakes, right?
It's absolutely mind-boggling. It's mind-boggling. Now, I see in the news the last couple of days that a Sanhedrin of 71 rabbis has formed in Israel, and now they're going to hold a trial, I believe sometime in September, in which they're going to try Pope Francis for allegedly committing some kind of crime in their eyes because he has recognized a Palestinian state. I must say my hat is off to the man for recognizing a Palestinian state, and I admire his courage for doing that, because he knew that the payback, that there would have to be some payback, and it did occur. I might also mention that when he took the trip to Israel, of course, he bowed down before the powers that be. When he visited that Vashem Holocaust Museum, he didn't go into the room where there's a wall painting, a wall picture of Pius XII, in which he's insulted and accused of being silent during the so-called Holocaust.
Tell us about that wall. What is that wall? What does it look like?
It's just an image of Pius XII on the wall, and underneath it is a statement which has just been modified recently, in the last several months before my book went to press. I'm not sure I could include it in the book, but basically it says that Pius XII was a man who was very cautious. He pretty much rooted for the German side, which is not true, and that he didn't do all in his power to help the Jewish people during the war. As I pointed out in my book, he did everything in his power to help the Jewish people. But one important thing that they always leave out is they imply that Pius XII thought or knew that there was a Holocaust going on. That Pius XII, even though American and British leaders were claiming from 1942 on that there was a so-called Holocaust going on, mass murder, he knew for a fact, based on contact with his own sources in the camps, including Auschwitz, that no such thing was going on. And his reading of the events was exactly the same as that of the Red Cross, who made periodic visits to the camp and knew that no such policy was in effect. So Pope Pius XII was silent, quote unquote, during World War II. It's not because he was silent about something he knew to be happening. He was silent about something he knew wasn't happening.
Warren, why do you think they are so adamant about going after Pius XII? What can it possibly do for them?
I think it's really not Pius XII. They want to have some kind of a bone of contention. They want to, that side always wants to be able to complain about something. They know in their heart of hearts that Pius XII was their best friend, was one of their best friends during World War II. And, being a non-belligerent party, being neutral, there were severe limitations on what you could say or do as a neutral party. They know that very well. This is just a pretext for constantly having something. It's like sticking the centurion or somebody else, sticking the spear in the side of Christ just to make him wince. And this is something that they find extremely useful to make trouble for the Catholic Church. I believe deep down in their hearts, they know that the whole thing is a red herring, and it's a useless point. But they control the media. They can decide what they want to talk about. They can turn the subject on or turn it off at will. And this has proven to be something that's gotten them tremendous mileage. Also, when the deputy came out during the Vatican Council in 1963, that play was not written by a Jewish author, but by a Protestant. And within Germany, there were, after the war, some feelings among the old aristocratic Protestant families in Germany who generally were more pro-Hitler than the Catholics were. And also, there was always an anti-papal tradition within the German Protestant community. The Jews just took this over once it was raised by Ralph Hakuth. The Jews just took this over and made it their own and ran with it.
Well, explain to the listeners a little bit about the deputy and why that's so important, and you bring it up quite a bit in your book, well, in the parts that you're talking about the church.
Well, Ralph Hakuth, I believe his father might have been a Lutheran minister, I'm not positive about that, but he came from a relatively religious upbringing, and in the aftermath of suffering that was imposed upon Germany, the war crimes. I just finished reading that magnificent book,
Hellstorm.
Yeah, absolutely, Hellstorm. Mm-hmm. The abominable crimes that the Allies leveled against Germany in its weakest hour in 1946 are just horrible. And in many ways, there was a great deal of internal discussion in Germany after the war. Many people, so thoroughly brainwashed as they were, believed a lot of the propaganda that the Allies had banked into their head about war crimes and about the uniqueness of German guilt against the Jews and so forth. And so there were recriminations back and forth. Adenauer was a Catholic from the Rhineland, and the Catholics generally got better press in Germany, or at least abroad. Catholics got better press than the German Protestants, who were looked upon as, you know, the extremists for Prussia. And so there was a resentment there. And so Ralph Hawkins wrote this play, and in the play, the deputy, he creates, he supposes the existence of a young Jesuit priest, an Italian fellow, and this young Jesuit priest somehow manages to make a trip to Auschwitz, and he sees all the gas chambers and everything, and he goes back and he tells Pius XII about this, and gets word to Pius XII that there's all kinds of gas chambers and horrors going on at Auschwitz. So you can see on that basic point there, the play has nothing at all to do with reality, because mm-hmm. in reality, nobody ever told Pius XII that there were gas chambers. In mm-hmm. fact, the information that he had coming from him from all sources, seconded by the Red Cross, was that people were receiving mail, they were receiving their food packages, people were coming and going every day. There were thousands of professionals going in and out of the camp every day, the main Auschwitz II Birkenau camp, from all the many factories that were located in the 10, 12 miles all around the camp. It was a huge, busy industrial complex. There was no secret extermination program going on. So when he, Hochuth in his play, he claims that this Jesuit was able to come back, he was able to infiltrate and escape and then come back and tell the Pope that there was an extermination program going on. Then the Pope insisted on, remaining silent. Well, no.
It's hard to believe that this Protestant German came up with this all on his own. Do you think that he really was believing in all this, that he thought it was his duty to write this play?
He wrote the play because he wanted to discredit Pius XII, and basically he wanted to discredit Pius XII as a symbol of Catholicism. And so this young man goes back to Auschwitz, he dies, meanwhile, Pius XII is shown repeatedly on the stage. He's sitting on a big throne, like a potentate from the 17th century, sitting on a big throne, completely removed from what's going on, whereas, in fact, in reality, he was terribly concerned about everything that was happening during the war and spent much of his own personal fortune. He came from an Italian aristocratic family, spent much of his own personal fortune to help those people who were suffering during the war years. So the play has absolutely no aesthetic merit to it. It was also mm-hmm. extremely long, 4 or 5 hours in length.
Oh, yeah.
It had no merit. It was all just polemicism, just trying to start a fight. When it was first shown in Paris, there was fighting in the theater. Brawls broke out in the theater. People fought back and forth. It was never shown in Italy for fear that there would be riots and murders. It would be even more violent than in France if it was ever shown in Italy. But it was shown in Berlin, New York, and
it got so much publicity. And I mean, they were writing about it in the Time Magazine, Newsweek. I mean, everybody was being told about it.
The mainstream press jumped on it. The mainstream press just loved it because it projected Jewish victimhood.
Right. And so how is it, has it come back recently into being produced again, or what is the story with that? That play, The Deputy. I thought there was something about it had come back again. Because it had been sort of dropped out of sight.
A movie was made. A French producer made a movie about 2003 of The Deputy. They made a film version, but they released it in Europe, but the release in the United States was extremely restricted. They never showed it in more than 6 movie theaters at the same time. It only kept it in this country for about 2 months. And I think one of the reasons why they did that was that the movie came out in France, and then, of course, it was shown in Germany. The movie came out in France and Germany just about the same time that Mel Gibson was making a movie about the sufferings of Christ. In this country, that movie aroused tremendous opposition from the Anti-Defamation League and organized jury. It was a terrific movie. I love that movie. It was a fantastic movie.
Yes. What's the name of it? I can't think of it. What's the title of that movie about
the
Christ?
The Passion of the Christ.
The Passion.
The Passion of Christ. That was,
right.
That was the movie that Mel Gibson made in 2002 or 2003.
Right.
He couldn't find any Hollywood producer. He got some independent guy to help him out with the financial end of it. And then he got an independent distributor to distribute the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And Hollywood was totally and completely opposed to it. Well, the French movie along the same lines was made at the same time. And my guess is that the Anti-Defamation League and the Jewish organizations felt that if they had made a big push after they had spent so much capital, so much of their credibility capital, fighting Mel Gibson, if they then turned around and launched a big propaganda campaign on behalf of the deputy, a movie version of the deputy, they would have actually only embarrassed themselves even more. So, but that movie does serve a purpose. The film version of the deputy in France and in Germany is shown to high school kids for brainwashing purposes. So, it's still used. Remember, a child in France, in a school in France or Germany, a child can't say to his teacher, I think that's a bunch of baloney what you're showing up there. I think all this gas chamber stuff is terribly exaggerated. A kid who would dare to say that in school, he's going to get sent down to the principal's office and maybe expelled from school pretty darn fast.
Mm-hmm.
So because it's officially outlawed to question any aspect of the Holocaust or to minimize it even 1% in Europe. And kids in school live in a state of terror when that subject comes up. They just undergo their brainwashing. Although it's often said, you read in French newspapers, that Arab kids in neighborhoods with the Arabs are the majority population, that the teachers are very, very hesitant to even bring up the subject because the kids in the Arab-speaking communities who live in neighborhoods where there's 80 or 90% unemployment, since these people are not integrated into French society at all, well, kids won't even listen to Holocaust. They won't even listen to Holocaust propaganda in class. They just tell the teachers to go get lost. And so they pretty much... They're still looking for more ways to brainwash these poor kids about the Holocaust.
Yeah. Well, what about, let's go into Cardinal O'Connor and how Wiesel got in with him.
That's a sad story.
Yes.
It's a very sad story. Cardinal O'Connor, in the late 90s, he made a trip to Palestine and, in his position as the head of the Catholic Near East Society, that's an organization that went back to the early 20th century. The Catholic Near East Society had been created by a Pope back around World War I to look after Catholics living in the Middle East. And then after World War I, when the Ottoman Empire was dissolved, the Vatican had more power to impress itself and had pretty much control over the Holy Lands and the sacred places and was really concerned about protecting the people who belong to the faith there. Well, Cardinal O'Connor, as the Archbishop of New York, was the traditional head of this papal organization. So he made a trip to Israel. And on his trip to Israel, he visited with the Palestinians. He made the trip to Israel, and his prime purpose was to go and visit with the Palestinians and the Catholic churches and parishes in and around Jerusalem. And when he was leaving, he was at the airport, and he asked him what he thought about the Holocaust. So he wasn't a diplomat. He was a big, nice, good-hearted person. Oh, he broke into tears. So when I think about the Holocaust, and he starts sobbing and weeping at his press conference, and he said, well, in many ways, he said, you people can say that the Holocaust was a gift to the world. And by that he meant it perhaps in some mystical way. You know, Catholics have this thing about Christ's suffering brought redemption to mankind. So he was liking the Holocaust to Christ's redemptive graces, which as a Catholic offends me that he did that. Well, by the time he got off the plane in New York, who knows how many rabbis and Jewish organizations were lined up. Within a day or so, he was confronted by a letter from 50, 60 Jewish organizations saying that you're completely off base to say that the Holocaust could have had some good purpose to it, some redemptive purpose, or whatever you implied. Louis' intentions were perfectly good when he said that the Holocaust might have been a gift, to the world. Of course, the Jews, they always just like, they're always outraged over Pius XII. Here, they had this sap, Cardinal O'Connor, a nice man, but just a big dopey dildock, a sap. They had him when they wanted him, and they were going to work him over, which is what they proceeded to do for the next 10 years, off and on. So they made him sweat. Well, after this happened, he was getting attacked day in and day out in the pages of the New York Times for his insensitivity for what he had said, even though it was just a verbal misstep. He meant no harm. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden, Elie Wiesel appears on his doorstep. And Elie Wiesel, in the guise of a parish priest, he comes over to Cardinal O'Connor, and he wants to pat him on the back and have Cardinal O'Connor put his head on his shoulder and receive some pastoral counseling. Well, Cardinal O'Connor then, this becomes a subject of an article in the New York Times by Elie Wiesel, came over and did all these nice things for him and made him feel good, and embraced him when all the other Jews were making life difficult for him. And so he was under the control of Elie Wiesel starting at this point. It's almost diabolical. Well,
so this is what you call an abusive relationship. That first they attacked him and weakened him, and then this other good Jew comes along and is nice to him.
Exactly. Carolyn, this is good cop, bad cop.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
good,
right.
Good cop, bad cop. A poor guy, he's caught with a DUI. There's a good cop, there's a bad cop. The good cop, bad cop's going to give him a tough time. And the good cop comes along and says, listen, I can fix this whole thing for you. You give me $250 right now, I can fix this. And you, so there's a bad cop and a good cop. And so he's like, he's a good guy, he comes along. And what, it's just terrible. So we get to the following spring on the so-called Kristallnacht, the anniversary of Kristallnacht, when Jewish businesses were burned in retaliation for, I forget what it was that the Germans were retaliating.
Well, there was a diplomat that was murdered in a foreign embassy.
It was an assassination attempt.
Yeah, it was in France.
Assassination attempt, a German ambassador. Or an assassination.
And then it you know, purposely got screwed up, messages that were sent out in order to anger enough people that they did some things, and they were told that they could go and do that. But it was really not from the higher ups. It was another one of those setups, but that's a different subject.
I forget what the year was. It was the 50th or 60th anniversary. Kristallnacht might have been 1990-something, or whether it was 2000-something, I forget the exact anniversary, but Cardinal O'Connor decided that he was going to celebrate Kristallnacht, and he had the bells at St. Patrick's Cathedral rung all night, and he wanted the lights left on at all the Catholic churches in the Archdiocese of New York all night long, and this struck me, as I expressed in my book, as an absurd and unnecessary statement. First of all, the Catholic Church had nothing to do with the events that took place in that particular night in mm-hmm. Germany back before World War II. So mm-hmm. by doing such a thing, he's admitting, or seeming to admit, that the Catholic Church has something to be repentant about, which is not the case at all. And then there's the whole question of cost. Everybody's concerned about utilities and cost of coal, electricity, all the rest of it. And it's basically all the Catholics in the pew, ordinary people, not the fancy ones who have lots of money and attend church at St. Patrick's Cathedral on Fifth Avenue in New York City, but the ordinary Joe Schmoes who go to church, who have to pick up the tab for all these extra electric bills and so forth that the Cardinal incurred just to impress the Jewish editors at the New York Times with his public show of guilt, which is totally unjustified in the first place. So finally, this whole thing went on. Cardinal O'Connor, the last 2 years of his life, he had some kind of cancer And he was always a trim. He was a big, tall guy, but he's always trim and in good shape. And the last 2 years, undergoing these treatments, all of a sudden his face swelled up like a balloon. You'd see pictures of him in the paper, and you couldn't recognize him. And it looked to me to be a side effect from the cancer treatment he was getting, whatever they were. Before he died, he wrote a letter to Wiesel in which he apologized for every time in the history of the world that any Catholic had been impolite or in any way to a Jewish person. And he sent this letter to Elie Wiesel. And once again, I object to this because nobody has a right to apologize for anything that someone else did, especially when it's in different times, cultures, and circumstances. You do not have a right, we don't have a right to apologize for anything that took place in the 50s or 60s or way back, especially not in the Middle Ages and beyond, because we weren't living at that time. We didn't know what the circumstances were. We didn't know what the other side was doing. So he got this letter from Cardinal O'Connor issuing this universal declaration of guilt and apology to Jewish people everywhere and of all time for Catholic guilt. And what does Wiesel do? He takes it. He gets his friends. They come up with a couple $1,000s, and they publish it in the New York Times as an advertisement. Anything for short time gain. It's just so crass. It's just about everything that Wiesel puts his hands on is totally crass. And as I said, not only for putting it in the paper, but violating the privacy. This man was supposed to be his friend, and had written him this letter in confidence. He violated that privacy.
Really? So he didn't. He didn't write. Wiesel knew that. I thought that the letter was written as kind of an open letter, but it was just written personally.
No, it was written to Wiesel. It was a private letter. Uh-huh. It was a private letter to Elie Wiesel. No, it's a. You know, maybe O'Connor might have figured that someday it might appear in a book or something like that. But a front page ad, as soon as he got it, bingo, he called right over to his buddies at the New York Times, and he puts this in the paper. And this whole thing about apologizing for what happened in days and centuries gone by, I'm totally, totally and completely opposed to it.
Well, you know, what comes to my mind, I might as well bring it up now, or it fits in, and that is that this business about guilt, I would say that guilt comes from... It actually comes from religion, Warren. And so now religion has to deal with it, being directed against them. Why should we have guilt? The whole idea of guilt and innocence is being misused all the time and has its source probably in what I would call priestcraft going way, way back by telling people that if they do this or they do that, that it's wrong and they're guilty. And now we have to deal with that guilt being used against us. I think that the reason why these Jewish groups wield so much power isn't only that they're able to blackmail people because of their media power and their money and so on, but it's more because we're so susceptible to feeling guilty. And the more religious we are, it seems like possibly the more susceptible we are.
I agree with you completely. Who is more guilty than Netanyahu of war crimes? And but he doesn't have to worry about anybody ever mentioning his name with the term war crimes in a sentence in the United States because of the nature of who controls the media.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is the media. But, you know, I think even the power of the media wouldn't have the strength that it has if we were not so susceptible to the idea of guilt. We're so easily convinced of being guilty.
I agree completely. And there are some Christian roots to all this too. You know, over the years, the churches, Catholic Church and mainstream Protestant churches have emphasized guilt where we're guilty of
to control people,
of sin and so forth.
Right.
So the Jews artfully, in their media control, they artfully transfer this guilt away from an offense against God to an offense against the Jewish people.
Well, exactly. You put that perfectly. You know, that's exactly what they're doing, and they're getting away with it, too. And maybe this is something we need to wake people up to, but there are so many organizations that are of our people who use guilt to their own benefit, you know, to make people guilty, that they don't want to give that up. But maybe some more light should be shed on that particular subject in the right way.
Absolutely.
Well, so is that the end of the story with poor old Cardinal O'Connor? And then there was,
I think we're pretty much, done with Cardinal O'Connor. Although I might go on and add that, his successor, Cardinal Dolan, when he came in, the first thing he started doing 7 or 8 years ago was establishing contacts with all the Jewish power brokers in New York City and establishing himself as a complete sycophant, doing everything but shine the shoes of these individuals. I might add another very, very troubling thing that Cardinal Dolan does. I didn't treat it in my book because the time frame for my book ends in 2010. It's something that he's adopted just, it's a practice and a habit he's adopted just in the last 2 years since Pope Francis came in, and it's very troubling. It's the habit when he meets with important Jewish groups of taking the cross that he wears, the pectoral cross, and tucking it inside his garment. Let me just explain what this is involves. Bishops in the Catholic Church have a distinctive garb, item of clothing, which consists of a large crucifix they wear around a chain suspended from their neck. And this cross hangs on their chest, and it's called the pectoral cross, or the cross over your heart. Pectoral is the word for heart in Latin. So bishops, when they're dressed up in their finery and doing their job as bishops, they wear the pectoral cross. When Pope Francis came in and he continued the dialogues with the Jewish interlocutors, he adopted the habit of taking that pectoral cross and tucking it inside his shirt so that it wouldn't offend them. This is absolutely amazing. Jesus said, I don't know how many times in the Gospels, that if you deny me, I will deny you when you get to the pearly gates of heaven. If you tell people you don't know me, I'll tell the Father in heaven that I don't know you when you get there. And yet Pope Francis, there are so many pictures of Pope Francis on the web now, of him meeting with various rabbis and having the cross tucked inside his shirt so he will not offend these people. Why is he afraid of offending them? They hate Christ. They hate the Catholic Church. Mm-hmm. They hate Christ. They don't want to see the crucifix. They absolutely hate Christ with all their guts. That's why he's doing it, so as not to offend them. Well, why should he be dialoguing with such people in the first place? And why does he take the extent of denying Christ? If Holocaust denial is such a horrible sin in the mainstream media, denying Christ on the part of a Pope would seem to me to be just as serious. Well, Cardinal Dolan of New York, since he's a prominent archbishop, the difference between an archbishop and a cardinal is that a cardinal has a voting right. Archbishops don't have voting by their office, don't have voting right for the new pope, but cardinals do have the right to vote when the time comes for a new pope. Cardinal Dolan does the same thing. And even when he's not just speaking with rabbis, even sometimes when he speaks to a Jewish group, when the rabbis are in the audience, they'll do the same thing. And to me, that is a denial of Christ, to see someone in that highly elevated rank of the Catholic hierarchy doing something like that. For this particular audience, it raises questions. Why is he doing it? And for the simple reason, of course, is that that cross Christ is offensive to them. And why is it offensive? Because they hate everything that Jesus Christ stands for. Well, then why are we dialoguing with them? Why is he dialoguing with them and making so many concessions to them? So
they don't ask that question, though. But that is, of course, the most reasonable question. And this is where we come again to, where do these popes come from? Or where do these cardinals come from? Why are they so, why have they turned so completely now into feeling the need to please the Jews?
Yeah. I know it's really disturbing. It's very, very disturbing. I might add that the plan is, see, at the highest levels of the hierarchy, the representatives of the Catholic Church have definitely abdicated. They're just essentially like second-class rabbis. But for the Catholics in the pew, the ordinary people in the pew, they haven't had the courage yet to integrate the Holocaust story, which of course is nothing but a story. It has no basis in Holocaust story insofar as it's an extermination story. It has no basis in fact. But they haven't had the guts yet to impose this on the Catholics in the pew. There are liberals, Catholic liberals, who want to do this, but it hasn't happened yet. By this I mean, to take, for instance, if you take a Sunday from the calendar and you call it Holocaust Sunday, there would be people in the Catholic Church, far out fringe liberals, who would have a Sunday in the calendar called Holocaust Sunday. Or they might try to carve out a space for Elie Wiesel and present him as a saint of the church. These theologians, extremist theologians, who claim to be Catholics but are in fact essentially fifth column people working behind the scenes, working for the enemy. There are people who would want to create space for Elie Wiesel and put him on the calendar of the liturgical calendar as a Saint Elie Wiesel and have a Saint Elie Wiesel Day. That's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, the idea that we're just a hop, skip, and a jump away from seeing something like this happen. It's so absolutely frightening and terrifying. I felt that somebody has to tell the story of who Elie Wiesel actually is. What a low-down, sneaky, lying individual he actually is. And if hopefully some of your readers will be encouraged to go out and buy my book and see for themselves what a sneak he is. But Carolyn, if this actually happens, this would expose the Catholics in the pew to what the Pope is doing. I've never seen a picture in a Catholic publication. I don't look at them all. Occasionally I do. I've never seen a picture of the Pope with a crucifix hidden under his vest in a Catholic publication. But they're published routinely in the mainstream press. It upsets me. I just saw recently in the paper published by the Archbishop of New York, Catholic New York, is the weekly paper of the Archdiocese of New York. And they published a picture there just in the last few weeks of Cardinal Dolan with the cross tucked in while he's addressing a group of Jewish rabbis.
Oh, no.
So he's doing it in public.
Well, so then it's known, and nobody even brings that question up to embarrass them or make them answer for themselves for doing that. I find that shocking. You know, it's like, the Protestants seem to have caved in with the Jews or been Jew friendly going way back, but the Catholics held out. The Catholic Church held out. But then in the 60s, as you were pointing out there, you know, they started that effort against the Catholics. And I think a lot of it had to be people that they placed in there in high-level positions or key positions. And then the church kept going further and further and further trying to dialogue and be fair to the Jews. And, of course, that whole Holocaust is a key to all of this, all of their success in turning people, including Catholics, in this direction. Go ahead.
It's almost as if they're being blackmailed by somebody. And if you concede that that's a possibility, that from the highest levels of the Catholic Church they're being blackmailed, what could the subject of blackmail be? Could the subject of blackmail have to do with priests seducing young boys? Well, we've all been disgusted, absolutely disgusted, by these post-Vatican II priests doing such things. Could it be allegations maybe about the Vatican Bank, operations of the Vatican Bank, or swindles of various kinds? Well, we've seen all kinds of stuff about that over the last 15 or 20 years, so any new revelation wouldn't be any more startling than what we've already seen. But we don't know. But the fact is, whatever the reason, blackmail or not, that the leaders of the Catholic Church have abdicated, completely abdicated, what they were supposed to do. I think the biggest problem is, if there is a subject to blackmail, is that the powers of the international media in the Western world they can continue to present the Pope. For instance, since Pope Francis came in, he's presented like a folk hero. He's like the Johnny Appleseed. He's a wonderful folk hero. Everything he does is fantastic. Why? Because it became obvious the first day he became Pope that his traveling companion is a rabbi. His best friend is a rabbi from Buenos Aires. Pope Francis is not a scholar. Many Jesuits are scholars and researchers and authors of books of various kinds, theological and other subjects. Francis never wrote a book in his life. He never wrote a book in his life until several years before this most recent papal election, which saw him win in 2013. He published a book of dialogues with this rabbi in Argentina in which they talk about the Holocaust and so forth. So he was already working that side of the street when he was elected. So the word is out among all the Jewish mega-billionaires who control the press, continue to treat the Pope like a folk hero, and say good things about him, because after all, his traveling companion is a rabbi, and he's on our friend. He's our friend. Now, all of a sudden, we have this news that this new Sanhedrin in Jerusalem is going to be having a trial at which Pope Francis will be tried for having granted diplomatic recognition to the Palestinians. Will this mean that they will change? And we know that when they change, it means the whole media will change. That's what's amazing about the age we live in. When you and I were kids, different newspapers had different lines. Mm-hmm. Different newspapers had different editorial lines. Each one was different. Now, they're all exactly the same. Every paper is exactly the same. They're all controlled by the same five or six big companies, and they all give us exactly the same to do. Their methods might be slightly different. There might be a slight difference in method of presentation of lies between Fox Network and CNN, but it's still the same lies that are being told. They're just ditched up in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Well, how do you explain, though, that Francis has been so pro-Jewish and even pro-Israel, and now he's angered them, and knowing he would, by recognizing Palestine and being very pro-Palestine. Is he honestly trying to be fair and do what the church should do by being, you know, preferring one over the other?
This movement of recognition of Palestine reminds me of Pope Pius. He felt that the Catholic Church and the papacy have responsibility for Palestine, not only the holy places, but the people who live there, whether they're Catholics or not. That the Catholic Church is the living reincarnation, continuation on earth of Christ. And so, by Francis doing this, I thought it was a very, very courageous act. And in fact, it's only logical now for some group of religious Jews to do what they're now doing.
Yeah, because they cannot tolerate any kind of recognition of Palestine and the Palestinian cause. You know, yeah. They really can't tolerate that at all, I think, sincerely.
He seems to have his heart in the right place, at least on this issue. I want to mention one other thing about Francis and his election, which aroused a lot of suspicion when his election took place 2 years ago. And this is what concerned me. Before the election, after the sudden resignation of Benedict XVI, after his resignation, the mainstream media engaged in a constant search for the names of the 5, 6, 7 people who might be elected as the next pope to succeed Benedict XVI. Never was Francis Bergoglio, never was his name mentioned. In all the articles I read, never was his name mentioned. Finally, when he was elected, an article came out in the New York Times, and it said that when Benedict was elected, as the election was going forward, later on, a cardinal leaked this information, that as that election was going forward, all of a sudden, a group of liberals among the cardinals who knew about Bergoglio and his traveling companion, the rabbi, they started massively voting for Bergoglio. and the tide began to change. Originally, during the voting, each cardinal votes, and then you see up on the big board up above what the standing is for each one of the various candidates. And toward the point where Benedict XVI maybe had, he was 15 or 20 away from being elected, all of a sudden a massive number of votes started to add up for Bergoglio, and he looked like he might overtake Benedict XVI. But then Benedict XVI finally got enough votes, and he won with Bergoglio in second place right behind him. Mm. This information was never made public, to the best of my knowledge, in the years preceding 2013. It was never made public. Bergoglio's name was never mentioned after Benedict was elected. So it led me to suspect, when I found out about this, that Benedict's resignation might have been engineered by the liberals and the media and all the Jewish potentates who interfere in the internal affairs of the Vatican so that Bergoglio could be elected. After all, Benedict XVI, the media showed no mercy toward him, especially in the last 3 or 4 years of his pontificate. Mm-hmm. So when he retired, it was probably well known that he would be the successor. And then when you couple that with the fact that the official media never mentioned Bergoglio as a possible successor, here he is. He's elected in Migal. He's elected on the first ballot, as if everybody knew in advance that the fix was in, but nobody was talking on the outside. It's interesting, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and you know, then in that election, or it's like it reveals a pro-Jewish and anti-Jewish elements fighting within the church, and now the pro-Jewish has won out. Like Benedict represented those who are not so friendly toward the Jews. But the church by then had to act very friendly toward the Jews because of all that had taken place.
Benedict never had a chance because he had belonged to the Hitlerjugend during his during his youth.
But he still got elected.
He never had a chance. The Jews never gave him the slightest chance. And that at some point he had tried to change one of the Good Friday prayers in which the Jews are condemned as being enemies of Christ or enemies of the church. He had tried to change the prayer, and when he did, they moaned that he didn't change it the right way or hadn't gone far enough or whatever. Mm-hmm. Anything he did, they always found fault with it. And as I argue in my book, The Holocaust High Priest, it finally dawned on him that they wanted was the thing that the Jewish organizations wanted was for him to be out of there. And so that's exactly what he did. He just retired, he resigned, and he was out of it. And let it be out of his hands. And sure enough, the movers and shakers who were making everything happen behind the scenes, they brought Bergoglio, their man, in on the first ballot. Not only does he have a rabbi who's a traveling companion, his church in Buenos Aires is the only Catholic church on the planet that has a little chapel set aside for the Holocaust.
Oh, no.
it's enough. Yeah, it's enough to make you sick. It really is. He's got a Holocaust chapel. He's got a Holocaust chapel with little mementos and so forth associated with the so-called survivors. And that's why the extreme liberals in the Catholic Church who want to have a Holocaust Sunday on the Catholic liturgical calendar and then have a Holocaust Elie Wiesel feast day feel emboldened that their day has dawned, but they haven't dared. This has never been discussed in the Catholic press or publicly mentioned, but we do have the fact of the cardinals, archbishops, and bishops, and the Pope tucking their pectoral cross in their vest when they meet with rabbis, which is nothing less than a denial of Christ.
Right. Well, it's going to, you know, what? It's so obvious that things are not going to stay the same as far as the Christian and Catholic Church goes. Christianity seems to be doomed unless Christians stand up against the changes being made to their religion and churches. But how does Elie Wiesel, what is his relationship with Francis and with Benedict? Do you have any stories about that? He's been quiet lately, I know that.
John Paul II, during his long papacy, pontificate, I should say, during his long pontificate, John Paul II let it be known to third parties that he would be willing to meet with Elie Wiesel. And of course that would have occasioned the meeting of the Pope with the Holocaust High Priest. But Wiesel, his hatred of Catholic Church is so strong that he turned down every opportunity he had to meet with the Pope. He just couldn't do it. Remember, as I point out in my book, Wiesel was brought up as a hardcore Orthodox Jewish adherent. I can't think of the word that describes these people. The
Hasidic.
That's right.
Hasid.
As the Hasid. And as a Hasid, it's a mortal sin for them to set foot in the Catholic Church, which, of course, is something he never did. And even in France, after François Mauriac died in 1970, he was in Paris at the time, and he was in Paris at the moment when they had the Solemn High Mass in Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, attended by the President, Jacques Chirac, at that time, and his wife. Wiesel went over to the church with his publisher, Paul Flamand, who is also a Catholic. He went over to the church, but Wiesel refused to go in the church. He and his publisher stood outside. And he did so because of his upbringing, his raising. It would be a mortal sin for him to go into, at least as the Jews consider that particular sect of Jewish Orthodox people. The Hasid was considered a sin if he were to go into a Catholic church. Of course, that's not what he said publicly. He said publicly that he didn't go into the church because he felt more comfortable to remember his friend in silence. That's his big word, silence. And so he stayed outside the church. He wouldn't go into Notre Dame. So he's never been in a Catholic church. And if he were going to meet the Pope, protocol would most likely call for him for going into the Vatican and walking amidst all these beautiful works of art and past the chapels and so forth that they have in those buildings. So that would have forced him by protocol. After all, the Pope is the head of state, and you visit him, you don't meet him at Starbucks. Now, you have to go to where the head of state resides. So impediments like that were just too much for Wiesel. And I presume the same situation prevails with Francis. I'm sure Francis would be happy to meet with him. He's super liberal, and he's already compromised himself, as I've been saying throughout the broadcast. So it wouldn't do him any more disservice or dishonor to meet with Wiesel, but Wiesel doesn't want to meet with the Pope. That would be a sinful act on his part.
Well, what about, though, John Paul II, was he the second? The Polish Pope, who was Pope for so long, he did a lot of rather shocking things, too, in favor of Jews, too.
Oh, well, he did everything he could to encourage this cult of Jewry in the Catholic Church, and I'm leafing through my book here now quickly for the names of the two institutes that he created. Let me see if I can find it. The two groups within these two working groups that I talk about that are dedicated to remembering the Holocaust in the Catholic Church. This is where the extremists, the Holocaust extremists within the bosom of the Catholic Church, congregate. Let's see if I can bring that up.
You mean with dealing with Pope John Paul?
Yeah, Pope John Paul. Yeah, I see. Here are the two things that when Pope John Paul was Pope, it's on page 392. When Pope John Paul was Pope, he created two commissions. The first commission in 1998 was called the Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews, and it was called We Remember, a Reflection on the Shoah. He did that in 1998. And then, in 2002, he created another commission, the Pontifical Biblical Commission, the Jewish people and their sacred scripture in the Christian Bible. And these two commissions seek ways, essentially, to create links between the Catholic Church and the Jewish religion, where there are no links. What drives the Jewish side crazy is the doctrine of supersession, which has been the doctrine of the Catholic Church from St. Peter, the earliest days. And supersession means that the Catholic Church supersedes the Old Testament, the agreement or covenant between the Old Testament God and the Jewish people was superseded, and the God in heaven is only one. He now has a covenant with the Catholic Church, because the Catholic Church supersedes the Jewish people. What Catholic Church has taken the place of the Jewish people, and it's the direct heir to Jesus on earth. What Pope John Paul II tried to do in these two commissions of 1998 and 2002, the Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews and the Commission for the Pontifical Biblical Commission on the Jewish people and their sacred scripture, what he tried to do was get rid of this doctrine of supersession. And he began calling the Jewish people our big brothers in the faith. Now, if there is ever something more nonsensical as that, the Jews that he deals with and that he meets with, they don't pay any attention to the old-time Bible that we read. Their book is the Talmud. The Talmud is a book of comments, commentaries on the Bible. It is not the Bible. We do not read the same book. Catholics and Christians read what we call the Old Testament. Jews today, no matter what their stripe, from Reform to Orthodox, all the way to the Hasids, they read the Talmud, which is volumes upon volumes of speculation and critique of what a long time ago might have been contained in the first couple of books of the Old Testament, especially Deuteronomy, where it's a question of lighting the candles, keeping the Sabbath holy, marriage laws and rituals, and so forth. And so Pope John was so misguided in doing these things. It was bad enough that he recognized Israel in 1993, granted diplomatic recognition to Israel. But when he launched these two commissions, he opened the door for these things I've been talking about the possible creation of an Elie Wiesel feast day, if you can imagine anything so horrible, or a Holocaust Sunday on some church Sunday in the church calendar. It's absolutely frightening. It's frightening. Of course, when he died, he had been basically the Jewish Pope living in Vatican City. When he died, there was an orgy of adulation created in his honor by, of course, the Jewish-controlled and dominated press. He had made so many concessions to them, and we've just been talking about some of these concessions right here, they wanted to say thanks. And so we had to sit through all the networks, PBS, everybody, for 4 or 5 days, and it happened in Europe, in France, Germany, Spain, Italy, in those countries, not only in the United States and Canada and Great Britain, where we heard nothing but how great a guy John Paul II was because he was a friend of the Jews. It's just insane, just insane.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people are turned off, but if people are turned off, suppose there are millions of Catholics who are turned off. If they write a letter to their local Catholic paper, or if they write a letter to the New York Times, or their local secular paper in the city where they live, it'll never be printed anyway. It'll never be printed.
Yeah, they're probably afraid to write it, because they'll get answers to their letter by people accusing them of their horrible bigotry and lack of Christian compassion.
Yeah.
And this is why we should not have ever gotten so susceptible, so agreeable to this kind of thinking. But
well, another thing is that 3 movies were made, 3 movies by various Jewish producers were made, biographies of John Paul II, and those movies they were made for propaganda purposes. Obviously, they didn't appear in the movie theaters. Those movies are used to brainwash Catholic kids, and maybe even kids in public schools. I don't know, but they're made to brainwash kids in Catholic schools about John Paul II, whose validity, what made him such a great guy, was that he was a friend of the rabbis. So the brainwashing continues 24 hours a day.
Yeah, I remember, I never really cared much for John Paul. He was around for so long and he seemed so boring, but I do remember how they talked about what a great, he's just like the greatest pope that ever lived when he died. Just went on and on and on about him. Exactly. Really tired me out.
I want to say something about the people who made the movies about John Paul II and about the 5 days that devoted to John Paul II. They never mentioned two of the real bad downsides of his pontificate. First of all, while all these sex crimes were taking place, where priests were attacking boys and committing all these horrible acts, there were some high-ranking people who got that information to the Pope, and he basically never did anything about it. So that, to me, is a black eye on that Pope. But it's never mentioned by these people who are always telling us what a great guy he was. Secondly, the corruption in the Vatican Bank and the cardinals who were committing hanky-panky with taking the money contributed by the faithful and doing who knows what with it. He never cracked down on the Vatican Bank either. There were two glaring things. And to me, if people are going to canonize the Pope, why can't we wait 100 years to do it? Why did it have to be done immediately? And the Jewish people, the Jewish organizations, were the ones who demanded that he be canonized almost immediately and pushed for it almost from the moment of his death. And, of course, they got what they wanted.
You're saying that John Paul has been canonized, right?
No. He's been canonized. He is now called St. John Paul II. He's called St. John Paul II. And that was, there was no reason for doing that. Why couldn't they wait 40, 60, 100 years to canonize him? He doesn't have to be canonized. He didn't have to, but they put him right through. And of course, at the same time, these same Jewish organizations who are all for having him canonized, they're all completely opposed to the canonization of Pope Pius XII. I personally don't see any reason to canonize Pope Pius XII at the present time. For anybody to be canonized, each candidate for a canonization as a saint of the Catholic Church has to pass one difficult hurdle, and that is a certifiable miracle, quote-unquote, has to be ascribed to intervention of that individual. Well, so far, Pope Pius XII has never been cited by anybody. For instance, if somebody's a cancer patient and he or she is dying of cancer and gets up and says, I'm going to pray to Pope Pius XII right now, who's in heaven, and ask him to cure me. And then a couple of days later, the person gets cured. Well, that would be a certifiable miracle. But Pope Pius XII doesn't have any miracles on his side. Plus, I'm not in favor of canonizing Pope Pius XII any more quickly than anybody else should be canonized. Why can't we wait another 50, 60 years to let the dust settle? I'm sure he'll withstand the test of time, and we'll get that miracle. Now, what was the miracle that, that justified the canonization of John Paul II? Well, it's a very controversial miracle, and there are lots of people in the Catholic Church who think it was a con job. It never happened. It had to do with a French woman. I believe she was a nun. She was sick. She had some kind of a skin disease or some kind of an illness for many years and couldn't be cured. And then in the convent where she lived, people said to her, well, why don't you start praying to Pope John Paul II, deceased now, and who's in heaven? And then all of a sudden she received some kind of a cure, and the doctors came in and they said, oh, she's been cured. And so the miracle attributed by this woman to John Paul II is the miracle on which his candidacy could then go forward. But it was also hurried, so hurried. And there are many people who think that it was a scam, that the miracle is just happened too quickly. It was unbelievable for such people. I haven't studied the subject personally myself, so I can't comment firsthand, but I'm just telling you what I heard about it. I believe in waiting before these canonizations take place, if in fact they're going to happen at all.
Well, right, and I cannot see for the life of me how Pope John Paul should be a saint just because he was a pope for so long. Yeah, you know, I can't see that he did anything. I mean, what's saintly about him? Nothing. So the whole thing just turns people off if they're not a part of the faithful.
Yeah, I agree. I never saw I never saw any signs of sanctity. And two of the things I mentioned is toleration of the sex scandals within the Catholic Church, looking the other way, and his toleration of the Vatican banking. These are two big issues that were completely ignored, it would seem, by the people who were doing the canonizing. The Jewish organizations wanted him canonized, and the Catholic Church is in such a subservient position nowadays to the Jewish organizations. Well, you just give them what you want, and then they'll give you some peace and quiet. If you don't give them what they want, then they're going to be on your case when you wake up every morning. No. That's the impression you get when you look at this relationship from the outside.
Well, this must be extremely painful for you, which you've already said it was, but, you know, as a practicing Catholic and who's always loved your church, to see what's happening, it makes me sick. It makes everybody sick, but the people within the church, and yet I know I have Catholics in my family who don't have a clue about any of this, and if I would talk to them about it, or I haven't talked about it in this particular way, but, you know, they would just say, oh, I've never seen any evidence of that, and blah, blah, blah. You know, they're not open to it. So, you know, they're not interested. And they're, of course, they're so trained, as soon as you mention the word Jew or anything like it, to just say, oh, no, I'm not going to listen to that.
When Catholic men study in the seminary, and they get ready to become priests, and then they become priests, they're told over and over again, when you see anything in the paper that criticizes the Pope or the bishops, the official position of the Catholic Church, all the clergy persons, is to say nothing. They're told, seminarians, priests, I've heard so many priests say this to me, they're told to say nothing. Why? Because anything they say can be twisted by the Jewish-controlled media. So you're better off to say nothing. Because anything you say, they can take the words, switch the words around. So that's a glimpse that might help you understand some of the stuff that goes on, the silences, the resounding silences when accusations are made, and nobody ever says anything to defend, except maybe some spokesperson for the Pope, some of the designated spokesman in Rome who might make a statement. But ordinary priests in the parishes and around the world are told to keep their mouths shut, because their words can only be twisted. There's a lot of truth in that.
Well, of course, I think you're very brave in speaking out the way you do. So I'm going to ask you a question that's really impossible to answer, or we should at least leave it, that what can happen here? I mean, what is in store? How can any of this be stopped at this point, to be turned around, that these people have so much power?
Well, it's a very pessimistic, bad situation for the Catholic Church to be in, especially since the Church now, as I mentioned, those two commissions that John Paul II created, Catholic Church is weaving the Jewish Holocaust legend into its doctrine, and there are people who are thinking about having a Holocaust feast day, and Elie Wiesel as a saint of the Catholic Church.
And Elie Wiesel is the one who's been behind, partly helping to bring this situation about. So he's a total enemy of the Catholic Church, and here they are going to be worshiping you.
Yeah, it's you're right. It's very troubling. But these are people involved with these commissions created by John Paul II, and my book proved again, as many other revisionists have proven time and time again, that the Jewish Holocaust story is essentially made up. There never was an extermination program. There was a deportation program of Jews from the Reich, since world Jews had declared war in a big meeting they held in Amsterdam in 1933. They had declared war against Germany in the form of an economic worldwide boycott, and the German government therefore felt that all Jews were enemies of the state and acted accordingly, but did not want to annihilate these people. It just wanted them out of their country, where they had disproportionate roles in the professions, the arts, and so forth. And there's no doubt that the Holocaust never happened, as it's said to have happened. But now for the Catholic Church to be taking the Holocaust legend with all of its lies and treating it as if it were some kind of a form of revelation that God had made to us in the 20th century, it's just enough to make you sick, physically sick. It's so disconcerting to even think that such a thing is happening. And I'm not optimistic for the future.
No, I'm not either. Because I know what needs to be done is what the Reich was doing. That's what needs to be done. But it's less possible than ever now to do it. So,
There's a French writer in the early 20th century named Paul Claudel. Paul Claudel came up with an interesting phrase to describe these kinds of eras we're going through. He said that God writes straight, but with crooked lines. So if there is a God, and we have to believe that his handwriting is straight, he's writing straight. But we're going through a series of crooked lines right now, which do not bode well for the future.
Yes.
That's for sure.
Well, Warren, I hope your book continues to sell well. And once again, I want to repeat that it is available at the Barnes Review and at every major book outlet, including Amazon. And the title is Holocaust High Priest, Elie Wiesel, Night, The Memory Cult, and the Rise of Revisionism. And it's packed with information, and everybody should know what's in this book. I mean, everybody. Maybe that's what would make the difference. You've put a lot of effort into it, obviously, over a long number of years. And you're still working on another book. I don't know if you want to mention it or not, if you're far enough along with it.
I'll save it for my next broadcast.
Okay. All right. I think that this book is so very important for us today, so we need to, all of us, need to be trying to get people to buy it and to read it, or at least to read it and to loan it out to people, whatever. So, I want to thank you again, then, for being on, Warren. If you have any last comments to make to the listeners.
Thank you very much for inviting me on the show. I've enjoyed exchanging viewpoints with you, and I hope that your many listeners have come to understand what's really going on in the world as far as the Catholic Church and the Jewish organizations are concerned. Thank you again.
All right. And ladies and gentlemen, this is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour on July 13th, 2015.
Thank you.
Thanks
very
for
much.
Listening.
Bye.
Bye, Warren.